listening to the Central Station Podcast, where we bring you true stories of what life in the outback is really like and why many wouldn't live anywhere else. So pull up a stump, pop the billy on, or crack a cold one as we talk to the men and women who call some of the most remote parts of Australia home.
From the outside looking in, Tammy Krakow was living her best life. She and her husband were managing a large cattle station for a corporate pastoral company, the perfect place to raise their three beautiful daughters. She had, as she puts it, ticked all the boxes. But behind closed doors, things weren't all as they seemed. In this episode, Tammy shares her story of coming to the Northern Territory as a shy Jillaroo, only to end up becoming a completely different person. She is incredibly candid about the impact it had on her life and those around her. There were many hard lessons she learnt along the way, and she does not hold back in this episode. To start our conversation, I asked Tammy to tell me what she was like as a child.
I think I was very a caring kid and maybe a girly girl, but in the street that we lived in Adelaide, we had a lot of, like, there's a lot of boys in there as well. So I had to grow up pretty tough and to keep up with all of them at the same time.
It's funny you say that because I guess that's going to come back in later on in your episode when you find yourself out on a cattle station,
yeah,
being a girl but being surrounded by boys and feeling like you have to be one of the boys.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And in saying that too, I ended up at a agriculture high school that in town in Adelaide that I think it was 30% women in there. So a lot of our, you know, a lot of the group that I was with during high school too was blokes or guys.
And so you mentioned you grew up in Adelaide, but you went to an agricultural high school. How did that come about?
As kids, mum worked night shift a lot of the time in nursing. So we grew up in Adelaide and just in the hills there. Dad used to take us to our uncle's farm on weekends just to give her a rest and let her sleep. So I think that's where the passion started developing. Used to go fishing with, you know, my grandpa on the farm and do all that sort of stuff. And it just grew over time. And then they bought a cattle station in Northern Territory, and that's where I used to spend a lot of my Christmas holidays in that space. So I think going to Erbre was sort of following in my cousin's footsteps, but I just actually found that I love the lifestyle, I love the people, and I didn't know exactly where I wanted to be, but it had to be within the industry somewhere.
And so where is this station?
Mulga Park. So my cousin Shane is there at the moment, and it's just out of Alice Springs on the border of South Australia.
And so you used to get sent up on your Christmas school holidays for people who aren't in the Southern Hemisphere. Mm. That's our summertime. That's probably not the nicest time to go visit.
Yeah, it wasn't. I remember the generator used to get turned off at nighttime too. So I think that's back in the days before a lot of aircon and comfort. We still had some fans and hopefully a nice breeze. But yeah, I used to go up and spend the time with them. We used to do a bit of cattle work, and they also had a general store for the community that used to come in. And so that's how I spent my holidays. I love to get dirty. I love to be in the outback or the bush. And through my journey in high school and going through Erbre, I met so many cool friends that all come from farms and stations. So I was able to live through them and fulfill my dreams. And my best friend, Kelly, she has sheep stations outside of Broken Hill. So definitely spent a lot of time through high school visiting them with her and getting up to mischief.
Was the plan then after school to head straight out to a cattle station? Is that where you ended up?
You know what? So my parents split up, I think, when I was in maybe about grade 7. So if I'm looking back and to be honest with you, I don't think I really had a plan. It was just to be with my friends and, you know, to still be in agriculture. And so when leaving school, I went and did a bit of caretaking for Kelly's family's station while they went on holidays, and actually organised to go overseas as a nanny, as an au pair, because I thought it's really bad. I thought that I wanted to be a nanny and work with kids or be a governess or, you know, do the typical girl thing back then when you go on.
Yeah,
the traditional girl role when you go onto stations. So I actually applied and went over to America as an au pair, and I was hoping to get more, you know, out in Montana, Wyoming area, but I did find a really good match and ended up just outside of St. Louis for a lovely family there. So I was really happy with that. Like, looking back now, and I would have never known it was then, I was just chasing adventure, or I was either chasing adventure or running away, one of them. But I just always liked to do something new, and I was just trying to find, I think maybe I was just trying to find where I fit in and work out what was for me.
So what was the plan when you came back to Australia? Were you able to kind of cross that off your list and be like, all right, nanny, au pair, governess, not for me?
Yeah, 100% not for me. Not that the kids, and if they ever listen to this, not that the kids that I had were, you know, there was anything wrong with that. But when I come back, I was just like, what now? You know, you think things are going to be the same, but all your friends from school have left. Like, so this is a year and a half on from leaving high school. So they've all started getting their own, you know, their own families or lives and stuff. And you're like, oh, the Thursday nights are not going to be the same at the Maiden Magpie anymore. So it was going, what's next for me? And I started just doing a little bit of fill-in work. So working in some pubs around the Adelaide Hills and Strathalbyn, and then got a job working on a uranium mine. God knows how I got there. I got it through a friend, and why I did it, I think it was the money. Like, you know, it was good money. But it wasn't till one of my friends said to me, he goes, you need, he was in Derby or somewhere, and he goes, you need to come up this way, and this is the job for you. Like, this is what you'd love. So one night I was, you know, the mine had sort of shut down, it was breakdown. And so I was Googling jobs in the territory, and that's where sort of I applied for a few and got accepted. So next thing I know that, you know, March, I'm heading to the Northern Territory Catherine Rural College for induction. The people when we started, like, were a lot older, and it was a really good experience. But it did take me, and I do laugh at this, and I do tell people that, you know, it's okay to give it a few months before you feel like you fit in. I remember getting off that bus coming up from Adelaide, the Greyhound, and going straight, checking in at the Rural College and going straight to my room and sitting there for 5 hours, not knowing how to come out. And you're watching all these people walk by and going, oh, shit, what have I got myself in for? But it wasn't until I had to come out that I did. And, yeah, I'm really glad that I did.
I guess eventually you either get really hungry or you've got to go to the bathroom.
That's right. And it was a shared bathroom there too. So you do have to come out of your room eventually. Yeah, I come up and I didn't know anyone. I'd never been up this way before and didn't know anyone that was going to the stations. Yeah, didn't know what to expect at all. I was a bit of an oldie compared to what they are now, but 21 I was when I first come up. I could ride a horse confidently, but a quieter horse, like, you know, so then I was worried about the, you know, horses up here bucking and all the rest of it. So that was pretty daunting because we had to get on horses and get on horses in front of people. And I was worried that, you know, that I was going to get stitched up and all the stories I've heard, but it was scary and exciting at the same time.
What were the other people like that were going through the induction?
Back then, everyone was at the induction. Well, virtually everyone was at the induction. So it wasn't just new people into the company. We had the headstockmans, or second year, third years, like virtually everyone was there for some period of time. It was, I think it was nearly 2.5 weeks as well. So it was a long, long induction. But yeah, I mean, everyone was, most of them knew people. Most of them knew someone that had already been there, or they knew of someone. So they were able to form those friendships quick, and being a bit shy and quieter. And, you know, I sort of sat back for a little bit and, you know, observed and, you know, just, I suppose not weaved my way in, but was sort of cautious about where I went and what I did.
Did you ever think, oh no, like, what have I done?
Oh, yes. sorry, all the time. I was like, what have I got myself into? But I suppose it's not like there was mobile phones. Like the way you're connected with your friends, oh, I think I maybe had a mobile phone, but the reception was really bad. The only way you sort of connect with your friends is through letters or moving on to the station. There was one payphone and, 30 to 50 people. So half the time you're lucky to call your parents to say, hello, I'm still alive, because you didn't want to wait for the phone. So the access to communication is nowhere where it is now. We spent a lot of time out at camp, so we weren't in the station a lot, but it seriously took me a good 3 months of, like, I reckon every day going, what am I doing? But I'd still get up and do it, but I'm like, is this for me? And then one day it just all clicked and absolutely loved it. Our team was a lot older, so we had a lot of maybe like third and fourth years in our team. And so to progress and, to get the training that you wanted, you had a lot of competition with other people because, they'd been there as, longer and all this stuff as well. So, but yeah, no, it was good times. I actually really loved, and I don't know if it's because I didn't have the responsibility, but I definitely loved my first 3 years on station, before, you step into that leadership role, or, it was just a lot of fun.
So what was it, you said there was one day that it all kind of changed for you. Is there anything specific that happened?
I think we had a couple of people move in the camp. There was a couple of people in the camp that had power trip issues, and I was very quiet and just used to take it and, just do whatever I needed to do, whether they know that was power tripping or whatever it was. But yeah, that person or had left the camp, and things just become easy after that. Like, I, didn't feel that I was getting put down all the time, or what it was from, they say second year syndrome for some people. So I'd still talk to all these people today, but I think when they were able to move out the way, I was able to move up in my confidence and go, actually, I do know how to do this, and I'm not just getting put down because, someone's trying to have a power trip in that. So that's, I think, I still remember, I just still remember actually what I was wearing, the same day, what yards I was at, what I was wearing when I went, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Okay. Well, Tammy, I don't want to take this down a unsavory path, but what were you wearing?
Back then, I think it was all about the tan line. So I just had, we all got farmer's tan, didn't we? Or whatever you want to call it now, but I was feeling fit because after, you're in the camp and, you work a lot. So I was definitely feeling a lot fitter than I was when I started. And it was just a Canterbury red and blue striped Canterbury. And I've probably still got it today that my daughter now wears. But yeah, Canterbury top, and, I was in the yards, and I'm pretty sure I reckon it was like Mackay or Benno Yards or somewhere like that. And I was just like, this is where I want to be, and this is what I want to do.
It's amazing how by just changing the dynamic of the crew, that can change your outlook. Like, I was thinking when you were every day going, is this for me or is it not? My mind jumped to the work itself, or living remotely, all those other things. But really, there's so many aspects to it. So if someone doesn't necessarily stick it out, it's not it's not as easy to say as, oh, they can't handle living out in the middle of nowhere, or they can't handle sitting in a saddle for 12 hours a day. Yeah. Like, there's so much more to
it. Well, it's the, especially not having the communication and to being able to, reach out and discuss stuff or things that are going through your head or something with your friends, because there's no, there's no telephone or there's no way of having that communication with your friends. Like, you hold on to a lot of stuff in your head because you're like, stuff goes around and around in your head because you're like, well, what's actually going on for me right now? Like, and it's not until, and then the pressure builds up. So it's not until the pressure's released that you got, you know, you can realize and go, oh, this is what's going on for me. This is what's happening. This is why I'm feeling this way. And now that person's out of it, then I can move forward.
Yeah. I guess you don't really have a sounding board.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you manage to make a best friend in the camp. But yeah. Again, like you said, you're brand new there. You've got to, it takes time to build that trust with other people.
Yep. Yep, 100%. And it's not like you want to go talking about people behind their back, but it's about just going, you somehow need to like get a different perspective on what you're thinking sometimes as well. And it's not too common to be able to get that at stations. I mean, a lot of the, you know, now there's a lot of Starlink and stuff that people can, if they're having, you know, it's all part of my job. People call me and say, can I get a perspective on this? Like, you know, and it's just me now. I help them change that perspective and go, well, actually, maybe it's this. Or this. Oh, yeah. And normally it's just people hearing it themselves come out of their own mouth and hearing it through their ears that they can, well, their own ears, that they normally answer their own questions and own doubts about what's happening.
So once you survived first year and made it into second year, did you get a second year syndrome?
Oh, good question.
Should we find out?
Probably.
Do I need to dial someone who was in first year underneath you?
It's probably dial a number. Look. Again, dynamics come into it, team dynamics. Back then, we had to share rooms. So I don't know if many people share rooms these days, but I was living like one of the boys. I was in the boys' quarters. The other girl that was there, she was in the girls' quarters with me until she left. And then the next year, the same thing, like, you know, a girl come into your, you know, someone else you had to share a room with. And I just think it's so tough when you're living with someone and working with someone, but also sharing a room with someone as well, that you, especially that you don't know or you don't get along with too well. So, I'm going to have to say yes, there was some, you know, a little bit of ego or something that come in, a little bit, but still, I love the teams that we worked with. Like they're all a bit older and, you know, we all got along pretty well.
So what was life like back then?
So it was at Newcastle Waters, and so that's just outside of Elliot. So you're looking at about 750 k's south of Darwin, around that, so about 3.5 hours south of Katherine. Look, God knows how big it was. It Mamaloo, where we used to be, was like 1.1 million acres or something thereabout. So I think, you know, Newcastle's either double or triple that size. I reckon there would have been around, you know, 40 to 50,000 head on there, and predominantly breeders. And so they had a commercial camp and a stud camp. And I reckon we had in the commercial camp, we may have had about 15 people. So we used to, you know, break up into two groups when we needed to get more stuff done. What was it like? It was fun. It was hard. The work was, you know, the days were long. So we used to live out at camp a lot. It's good when you've got a good cook. When we camped out, I think there's a lot of like modern campgrounds. We had one camp van that the cook used. And so we would move that with us. We'd fill the water up. So, you know, it was self-contained water in there for the van and set up a bit of a marquee. And then we'd use all our, you know, had mozzie domes or those that were game, didn't have mozzie domes, and we'd just like camp out around, you know, in a certain area, so far from the kitchen, but so far away. Our showers back then were under a bore hose, like the bore head. So there was no, it was driving over to the turkey's nest, maybe five of you in a ute to go and shower. And being a female, you know, there was no, very rarely was there a tarp, or, you know, it's just a trust issue that you just like, you know, it was, you turn the other way while the other person showering, but I'm pretty sure that didn't happen a lot of the time. So I suppose in being so shy, like it took me 5 hours to come out of my room, but it was just one of those things that you just had to get in, get done. And in the end, you're just like, oh, well, if they're looking, they're looking. If they're not, they're not. Like, it's up to them. So yeah, definitely. I remember that first year, there were so many mozzies, like, because we're camping out near the lake, the Newcastle Lake and stuff. So there were so many mozzies, and I don't think I've ever experienced that many mozzies. So I went out. I remember the first night out at camp, and I could not sleep because it just the sound of the mozzies through the dome. And I was able to go, we had an opportunity to go back to the station to pick up the preg tester and spay it that next day. And I like straight away put my hand up because I had, back then we had those CD Walkmans. So I went, that's the only reason I wanted to go back to the station, is bring out my CD Walkman so I could drown out the mozzies at night. But it was rough but good at the same time. The days were long. I mean, sometimes we'd start at 3 o'clock in the morning, like to beat the heat and to get the cattle on the boars and then walk them out. So sometimes they were good days and other times they were longer days and water was few and far between. I remember one of the main rules that it was, you don't drink water until your horse has at the end of the day. So if you didn't have water between the time you left and the time you got there, like there's some pretty long days and, you know, the perishing sort of come in a little bit. So I remember one day it was after Melbourne Cup. I think we went in for Melbourne Cup and then we come back and we had to do a long walk, but these cattle were tough to walk and they got away from us once. And I was riding this big, it wasn't my horse, but it was a big blue-grey horse, and I had the water. I got given the water bottle, and I remember I dropped the water bottle. So that was like detrimental to the camp because he sort of took off, and I was like, oh no. So I don't think they liked me too much that day. And then by the time we got the cattle walking, and there was about three of us in the lead because they were coming on, when they started coming on water, they were really pushing. So the head stockman said, like, stop them. We, you know, don't let them go to water. Like, let's teach them a lesson and let's hold them up and teach them some respect. But we're all hungover. We're all looking at that trough, just going, we are perished and we couldn't get water up to us. And I remember by the time we were allowed to go there, we were drinking this water, but it was, I don't know if you've smelt that sulfur water before, like it was, it's horrible. So I think we're all a little bit perished that day and then a bit sick from drinking the water.
Were you drinking from a trough?
Yeah, we're drinking 100% under the, it was gross.
Oh,
it was gross,
lovely.
But we perished.
Oh, and also, because you dropped the water bottle as well. That would have been nicer water in the water.
Oh, yeah, it would have been, you know, the cold nice out of the cool room. But, yeah, I just couldn't handle this horse sort of didn't like the water bottle, took off, and I probably, shouldn't be too hungover on a horse again.
The days before Camelback.
Yeah. Well, actually, they did have them, but we weren't allowed, you know, I think it was a belief that we if we had them, we weren't tough enough. So it was people that had them may have got ridiculed for having them. So it was one of those things that you got to be tough and get through. So, and that's only from beliefs of, you know, people before, head stockman.
Culture is handed down. Like that's how you develop a culture. So
100%. It's totally different now. I mean, it's all about WHS and all the rest of it. So it was just what it was at the time.
And when you moved into your second year, so obviously you enjoyed it enough to come back, did you have any more idea with what you wanted to do with your life?
No.
Or you were just like, you know what, I'm enjoying this. I'm just going to run with it while I can.
I'm just like, no, I'll come back. After that first year, my friend that recommended me to come up, he actually passed away in a car accident. And I didn't go home. Like this comes into my biggest regret. I didn't go home for the funeral because I was scared if I went home, I wasn't coming back. And it was harder for me to go home and, you know, process that. And it probably took me 4 years longer than I should have, to process that death. But I was scared I would get, I don't know, stuck at home, and I loved it up where I was. So I never went home, and I went home a bit later, you know, I think beginning of the next year because I stayed up over the wet. So, but yeah, I don't think I knew the whole time I was working, I knew what I wanted to do. Like I just kept going and looking for the next adventure or the next thing or trying to chase what I thought I loved.
You did find something that you loved while you were at Newcastle Waters. Tell me about meeting your future husband, Cameron.
God. I don't know, Steph, if it started off as love. I think to be honest with you, I'm pretty sure it started off as a one night stand at Catherine's show in there. And that was, I think that was the first year that I was there. But, you know, he didn't move. I say that he moved over to Newcastle because I was there, but he didn't. He was able to get a promotion at Newcastle and, yeah, we were sort of, you know, in the camp and friends and until we weren't. And it very much comes into you living together virtually and working together, and there's no dating, there's no, you know, not much romance or anything like that. It's just sort of, you know, living together, working together, and, you know, you move on with your life. So
it's a real pressure cooker, isn't it? Like, you find out pretty quickly if it's gonna go anywhere.
Yeah. I think you find out pretty quick too, but I think it just all happens and you just go with the flow and all the rest of it. So it definitely didn't start out, and this is not detrimental to our relationship or anything, but it didn't start out as, you know, like one of those dating romances. I think it's like a lot of station things that sort of started off as a, you know, either a hookup or, you know, you're in the same space at the same time and you move through it. But in that, you know, we've had a lot of good times. We've had three girls. So got one, Dakota's 16 and a half and Cadence is 15 next month and Billy turning 14. So we've definitely, you know, had great times, but there's also been some pretty hard times living and working together in that as well. So that we've had to work through.
Yeah, so you just mentioned he got a promotion, which saw him transfer to Newcastle Waters. Is that right?
Yeah, so he was promoted to Newcastle, and then 2 years later he was able to go, I think it was like October, over into Mamberloo as a head stockman over there. So I by that stage I was in the stud and I was doing the stud TA stuff. So I continued my year at Newcastle Waters and then went over there, but I didn't want to work with him. So I decided that I was going to work in town if I couldn't get the cook's job, and it wasn't the cook ended up leaving a couple of months into the year. So I stepped into the cook's role there, as well as I still got to do all the preg testing, which I loved as part of being in the stud. So I sort of got the best of both worlds there, and then the position at Dungowan and come up like with the same company. So that was station overseer, like, or outstation over, you know, seer. So that was another step up. I think it's always a honour, or, you know, it always gives you like that sense of satisfaction every time you're asking, or, you know, you're going into that next position. And so Cameron went over and did this, the station overseer or outstation manager, whatever you want to call it. And I went over and I was doing that little bit of office side, as well as having kids. I'd just had Dakota, so she was only a baby. Yeah, baby when we moved over there. And then I'd get on a horse every now and then and be able to get out and, you know, did the cooking. So there was not much of a setup there before. There was one other little house. So they were giving us a couple of staff members. So we had to set up a bit of a quarters and stuff first before that they could come. So about halfway through the year, I think we got three staff members come over. And so I was cooking for them. So, and out of the house. So these guys would come over all the time. Absolutely loved them. Like, love the people that used to work for us or come in. But after time, and especially having a couple more kids quite closely, after time it sort of got a bit, you know, I got a bit over it. I couldn't really work out what it was, but having people in my house and having to wait on people, when, you know, they were all good. Look, don't get me wrong. They used to come in and help with the dishes, and they love, you know, sit and watch cartoons with the kids and all the rest of it. But it was my mental health that was declining in, you know, especially in my last pregnancy with Billy. I couldn't walk for the last 3 months. So I'd get up out of my bed and come in, and there's already, you know, people in my house at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I wasn't obviously at my best in there as well. So, and confronted with that. But in saying that, the guys that were there were great, but it was just what my perspective on everything was and what was going on for me at the time.
What was that transition like when you guys were at Mambaloo. So Cam was head stockman, you were cook, but you had a set of managers above you. When you go to Dungowan, like, you guys are the managers. Yep. So it's your first time kind of being like the bosses and having, and so not only that, so you've got to deal with that, with kind of being in charge of people now to a different level, like than Mambaloo. But also, as you said, the way the infrastructure of the homestead was that the kitchen was actually in your personal house. So rather than, as on many places, you go to a communal kitchen for meals, you had staff members coming into your home. And one thing that is, you know, I guess everything has two sides to it, but one of the best and worst things about working on a cattle station is that you live together and you work together. So you kind of always in each other's pockets, but usually at the end of the day, is particularly, I think it's so important for the for older staff, like when you have a family, you can go home and have that space to yourself, but you don't because everyone's coming to your house for dinner and breakfast.
Yeah.
So you're not really getting any, there's no boundaries there.
Yeah, no, we definitely didn't have boundaries. And, you know, I used to enjoy it too, because if I was home all day and they were out, I was looking forward to a beer and catching up and actually talking to, you know, adults. I don't know if you can call them adults, but they were cool. But, you know, I was looking forward to it too. So it was just, I was just in a cycle, you know, and my husband was in a cycle. He liked to be around, you know, people as well. So it was, I loved Dungowan for the, it's 60 Ks from Top Springs. You don't get many visitors or anything pop through. You could ride your horse in the afternoon. So I loved it for that aspect. And I did love the groups that we formed. I think it was just, you know, in that whole family piece, as you said, it's, you know, losing, probably starting to lose connection with Cameron or not know, like, you know, I was going through the paces and the paces weren't working for me anymore. So yeah, it wasn't until we went, you know, moved. I wasn't able to do Dungowan anymore. And it was because the office was in the house as well. So I'd wake up, look in the next room and there's the office and there's a kitchen. So it just felt like I was isolated within these walls. And, you know, we'd had the discussion and I said, I can't do this anymore. And I had that with the manager. So we still had managers, but they were over at Newcastle and they used to come over a bit. But it was sort of, I did feel that we probably didn't have the skills to be able to lead the people the way that efficiently, I suppose. So when I'd get people in to help or cooks come in to help, when we'd have contract musterings and stuff in, I don't think I was the best boss and leader because I didn't know how to do it myself. So I was sort of just expecting them to know what to do without probably me giving them instruction. And then I become pretty hard and tough and going, oh my God, like, you know, you become short with people, especially when you're mental health is sort of declining and you don't know what's going on for you and you've got people helping you, but you haven't been given the skills to be able to help them. And so then that projects onto them as well. Like, so it was just like now I look back on it, you know, a downward spiral, I think. And coming to the end of our time, I just said, I just can't do this anymore. So we were fortunate that there was some movement in management and we were able to go to Mambaloo, which sort of gave us a bit of a fresh start. But in saying that, Mambaloo now has that communal kitchen that you mentioned before when you go somewhere. So it was a huge transition for us to be over in the house. And, you know, I remember, and it's nearly heartbreaking that the kids, you know, it was dinner time and the kids were like opening the door, yelling out to the ringers, it's dinner time, because they're used to these, you know, we had Eric and Butto and they were used to them coming over and watching, you know, cartoons with them and doing stuff before that. So it was, you know, and so then it's a different transition going back to that. So we tried to, you know, stay as a family orientated station as much as we could, even though we were expanding in numbers.
It's a pretty big thing to be able to reflect back on and notice what was going on and admit that you weren't the best boss back then.
100%.
But also, like, how would you have known what, and also I'm just thinking about the change from how you described yourself earlier on when you first had your first year at Newcastle Waters and you were shy and you kind of sit back and watch and now you, like you I'm just going to say the typical station manager's wife. There is a stereotype out there, and I've worked for a few, and I'm happy to say that stereotype is still alive and well.
Yeah.
Obviously not everyone is the same, but there is this, and the older I get, the more I understand why people have been the way they are and why there is kind of this, you know, when you hear about, I'll use the finger quotes, like a station manager's wife is like a hard woman and a tough woman and sometimes a really mean woman.
Yeah, yeah. Resting bitch face.
yeah. And the older I get, the more I understand it. But the change that, and it's not something that happens overnight. Like, I'm guessing it's something that's happened really gradually. I mean, that's, was 4 years from when you went to Newcastle to ended up at Mambaloo when you first had kids. So, and then you were at Mambaloo for 5 years. So that's 9 years that it's taken for you to change.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think I ever actually realized until I stepped away from being on station that, because you don't have time to think and reflect really on what's been going on. Like, you've got a little bit, but there's so much going on. So definitely had resting bitch face and probably voice and everything that come across that throughout my time. Like, even at Mambaloo, it wasn't until the last 3 years that I really started realizing that I needed to change my ways and what I was doing wasn't working. So, you know, I had to put more effort in. I had to get curious about people and try and work out what was going on, but I also get curious about myself, because it wasn't until I started getting curious about myself and pushing myself into different roles is when I started realizing that what I'd been doing hadn't been working. And more so when leaving and having more time to reflect. I always say, you know, if I still had been in contact with a lot of people that come through in my care of being a cook and nanny or what have you, I definitely would write them a letter of apology and just say, you know, sorry, I didn't know. I didn't have those skills, but I definitely appreciate you and would have probably dealt with some things a bit different in that.
What do you think it was that caused that change in you over that period of time to become a hardened person and where you said, you know, you were short with people and your mental health was going into a decline?
I think I've sort of become the person who I thought I was supposed to be. So I think it's a lot better now, but it was a pretty, you have to be hard, you have to be tough, you can't have a day off. So these are all the beliefs and culture that had been imprinted. And it was it's an industry wide thing. It's not just that station. It's not that company. There's not a bad word to say that I've got a bad word to say about CPC. So I don't want any of this to come on. This is my journey and what was happening for me and what I didn't realize at the time of what was going on. So moving forward in that, it was the leaders before me. Like, I seen, I suppose, a stereotype of the person that I was supposed to be, and that's who I've become, and probably a little bit worse in there. I remember, you know, in Mambaloo and when we were at Mambaloo and I was able to step into some different roles, going away from just the typical station manager's wife for doing invoices and ordering carrots, I say, and please, I you know, some that suits some people, but it didn't suit me. So I used to push myself into different roles and I was lucky enough to have support from the GMs to help me and let see my potential into being able to do those different roles. In one of my roles in the end was doing, you know, I did the station recruitment for the company as well as organising the emerging leaders training and stuff. So I know that you've had Tyler Bonich on your show before. So when she first came to CPC, I recruited her. Well, I wasn't part of her recruitment process. And then she came for the training and she came in for the training that we did, our induction training. And then not long ago, she attended one of my workshops and she goes, oh my God, you're such a different person. Like, she said, you used to scare the shit out of me because I used to just go in and go, this is what's happening. This is, you know, don't do this, don't do this. This is what's happening. You'll be on time, you know, like full dictator, director type person. And in now, you know, hadn't seen her for a couple of years and then attending one of my workshops now, she goes, oh my God, you're just such a different person. my process and how that curiosity started coming around was every year we would do a junior head stockman or junior managers meeting, and I was able to help facilitate and organize that. So part of that, like a big part of leadership's communication, right? And behavior style and how we're acting and stuff. So we come across or had, you know, brainstormed a few different profilings that we could do. And the DIS profile is what we come across. So DIS profiling is a, for those that don't know, is a behavior profile that will give you a bit of an understanding of where you are in your natural state and your adjusted state. So your natural state is just something that you'll do without thinking. So unconsciously, you know, you just go do something. Your adjusted state is there's a bit of thought around, or you might be put in a position where it takes a bit more energy and stuff. So by being able to do the DIS profiling with a group, we could get a better understanding of where they all are, but give them the main reason is to be able to give them awareness of how they're acting and behaving, and to also then start identifying people in their team to how they behave and where their natural styles and adjusted styles are. And then how, you know, then the next step is how they can communicate with those people, because, you know, we're living and working together and communication's huge within the group. And often it is the biggest cause of issues within the team. So that's the tool that probably changed my life in my awareness, because when I did mine, it come, and I just have to say this before I go into this, no behavior profile like is better than another. So it doesn't matter where you are on it. It's just an awareness tool. But mine come back saying that I was fully dominant and I had no empathy and no emotion, and virtually, if you like, I was a or whatever it was, like there was nothing in there. And I remember telling the CEO at the time, and he just looked at me and says, as if you didn't know that. And I was like, oh, okay, rightio. This is how people are perceiving me. What's going on? And I remember speaking to Kristen, my dad's wife, and she said, like, I was explaining, oh, we just did this profiling, all this stuff come up, and this is what it's come back with. And she goes, well, that's not right, because that's not you. So who are you? And it still sort of gives me goosebumps now, because I suppose the turning point to going, okay, what has happened? What have I just gone through life? Who have I just gone through life living as? And what is it that I had to start getting curious about? And I didn't change, like still had work to do, but it was definitely the point where I started getting curious to what was going on.
I guess it's something that doesn't happen overnight either. Like it's not like you made a conscious decision that, you know, I'm going to become a hard ass and then that was it. It's things that happen gradually. And I also think it's really easy to start to wear a mask, even if it's just for 5 minutes at a time. So you might be your innate Tammy, but then you've got to go out to and work with a whole male crew in the camp. So you're like, all right, well, for today, I'm going to put this mask on and be hard ass Tammy. And then over time, like you go home, you take the mask off. But every time you put it on, like, it's like, I don't know, putting on makeup, and each time a little bit, you can't take it all off, a little bit stays on. And there's a quote, I'm not going to get it right, but it's something like, you can only wear a mask for so long before forgetting who you were underneath it, or you can only have two faces or something before you forget which is the real one.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's
gives me goosebumps.
It's
100% where I was. And I was just, when you're saying that, I was just trying to go back, and whether I was trying to create it or I think it was just going, And it wouldn't have been consciously. I wouldn't have been consciously going, okay, you need to, maybe it was. I did get told I need to toughen up a few times. So I think it's a slow consciousness that goes, okay, well, to keep up and to get recognized, you need to step up. And if that step up is, you know, and I think that was probably the first 3 years maybe of just going, you need to do this. You need to prove to people that you can do it. And by proving it, you've got to become like them. So once, and as you said, when you're wearing that mask too long, you don't know who you are anymore. But I wasn't sort of maybe consciously aware that I had changed that much. I probably knew I'd changed, but I wasn't aware that that's what was going on.
Once you have that insight, where do you go from there?
Look, I don't know where I went from there. I was lucky and fortunate enough to employ, and I think this is where it started changing. I was lucky and fortunate enough to employ Amy. Amy was come as a nanny admin person for me in Mambaloo, the most sweetest and still is kindest person, fun, always had a smile on her face, always just, you know, get in and help. And, you know, we're such dear friends now. And I've had a couple of really good people, Kate Murphy come in and then Lily, I think, look, I can't remember what order they come in, but I think then it was Lily and I think they softened me. I think all three to four of those girls helped me in my journey. And this is what happens a lot is you're unhappy, right, within yourself, but you think a fresh start or a new place is going to make you happy and or a new position, and it will only keep you happy for so long. It's just a change. And I find this with other people that come in and they're like, oh, I want this or I want that. I want a position. I said, but is it because you want a pay rise or is it because you need a bit more? What's going on for you? Mm. So, and I think it was thinking that if we had a fresh start at a different station, then I'd make myself feel better, and you only feel better for a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
Until it all starts compounding.
Because I was wondering about that when you said, you know, we're going to Mambaloo, and I was like, all right, well, if, you know, what was the cause, like the root cause of the problem, and did that get fixed at Mambaloo? And it sounds like you've definitely got some insight into yourself through that DISC profiling. Mm. You've got to start doing some other kind of different roles. But, from what you've just said, then does that mean it didn't kind of get better? Did it? Was it a Band-Aid for only for so long?
Oh, 100%. It was I think the smallest Band-Aid you could get. But I think mental health was still not that common. Like to tell you the truth, I didn't even really know what it was. Like I just knew that I was crying all the time, or you know, I wasn't happy, and then you feel bad because like you're not happy, like so you're in your own thoughts because you're too scared to say anything to anyone because are you then incapable of doing your job? So you keep a lot of this internal stuff to yourself, and 100% is what I did, and 100% don't recommend it. It was then, you know, as I said, it was just compounding, like again, compounding, and it wasn't – and look, probably – let's go into that compounded into of me being unhappy. What do they say? Happy wife, happy life. So let's go with me not being happy and not knowing who I was. I probably projected it onto my family a little bit. So by this time we'd had three kids, you know, young kids, and they can be hard, or like it takes effort and energy and all the rest of it. And Cameron was in his prime of running a cattle station, then all the people that were around us, and look, it wasn't working for us. We didn't know, we couldn't acknowledge it because we weren't communicating, but I just thought that that's how life was supposed to be. I thought that's what, you know, having kids was. It was going to get better after, you know, we'll start talking again, we'll, you know, and when you live and work and do everything, like what is there to talk about? It's either kids playing up, or we didn't have future aspirations or anything, what sort of what we're working towards, so that we couldn't talk about that. And it was normally just about people at work or what had happened for the day.
The daily grind.
Yeah, the daily grind. And I don't believe he was fulfilled. I wasn't fulfilled. But we sort of just kept doing our job. So I buried myself into my work and took on more responsibility. And he buried himself into his work. And, you know, it was like we become housemates and not anything else. But in that time, like looking back, I can say that's what was happening. But at the time, I didn't know what was happening. So it compounded, and I was probably the fittest. So not only did I bury myself in work, I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to be in towns, or, you know, close to town. So I had a great personal trainer that we used to train 2-3 times a week. So I'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd go into town, do my training, come back, and bury myself into work and do stuff because that's where I was getting my recognition from. I was like, shit, yeah, you know, you've just gone and pumped weights. You've done 50 kilo press and everyone was impressed with me at the gym and because how far I'd come. And then I'd go to work and I'd help people. So that's where I was getting my recognition from. It made me feel good. So the more, you know, like anything that makes you feel good, you do more of. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have boundaries in place, didn't have anything. And it wasn't, I think it was 2016 or end of 2015. You know, the dates aren't important, but it was coming up to the wet season. I just wasn't feeling well. I was getting twitches and I was just like, I need to go get, you know, there's diabetes in my family and heart disease and stuff. So I thought I need to really look after myself and go get checked. And I booked myself into the doctor and, you know, Dr. Google come out a fair bit at the same time. So that's not always a good sign. But I went in and had to do a fasting blood test. And it wasn't until I had that test and needles never used to bother me. And I thought, oh God, I really don't feel well after this. And I sort of walked out to the car because you had to be tough. And I did call my husband and said to him, look, I don't really feel well. I don't know if I can drive home, but I could hear that he was busy in the background. And of course you just go, okay, that's right. I'll have that teaspoon of cement. I'll be right. I'll be home soon. And on my way home, like we're only 15 Ks out of town. And I was about to turn on to the driveway and I didn't know how to turn my indicator on. So I was driving. I knew that I had to turn my indicator on, but I had no idea how to. And so then that plays on your mind. I wasn't going to tell anyone because I was just like, what the hell's going on? But I didn't know what was going on. So for the next week, I was sort of Dr. Google again, you know, what could be happening. So, you know, was I productive at my work at this time? No way, because I had all this, you know, other stuff going on, but you're just throwing those masks on and you're doing, you know, yep, I'm okay stuff. So Cameron had to go to Darwin because he was going overseas on his Nuffield scholarship and he had to get an injection. And I said, oh, well, I'll come up with the kids and we'll go shop, you know, we'll go to Casuarina. And I got into Casuarina and I just like, no, I said, I'm going to come to the doctors with you. I don't think I can deal with kids in here. So then he sort of rolls his eyes because he's like, oh, what's the matter with you? And, you know, all the rest of it, we didn't know any better. And I sat in the car and I was like waiting for him. And I remember going in, going, I just need to go get checked. Like I'm not well. And I sat down and I thought I was having a heart attack. So, which ended up being a panic attack, but the doctors didn't have any idea what was happening for me. And so that made it worse because they were doctors and they're like, nah, everything's normal, whatever's going on. And it wasn't until they called an ambulance and the ambulance come in to take me to hospital. He said to me, you're having a panic attack. And I think those words for me were just like, you know, what the? Because I was a person that was so in control of my life. Well, I thought I was in control of the life I thought I should be living and not so much in control of the life that I should have been living. So I think I cried more when he told me I was having a panic attack because that meant what I knew about panic attack or nervous breakdown, that meant I was no longer in control. So that there, I think, was the biggest turning point for me in going, okay, well, now what's going on? Because I didn't even know what anxiety was. Like I wasn't aware of what stress was, what anxiety, you know, depression, yes, but not anxiety. So it was not funny, but because I was went to the doctor's surgery. My husband was, what was the matter with her? Like, you know, she's doing whatever she's doing. And then it wasn't until he got the phone call that your wife's been taken off in the ambulance and she's on the way to hospital that he realized that something was really wrong because we both didn't know, like, you know, what is it? But what did that lead to? That led to, yeah, I was in a hospital for half a day and made sure that I was right. And then, you know, sort of went home and, it took about 4 weeks to overcome that. So the next couple of days after that, Kate rocked up. She was the nanny and an admin girl for us there at Mambaloo. And it was embarrassing because I had to say, hey, like, here's the kids. I'm going away for a week because I had to remove myself on the station because I don't believe you can you can't heal where you hurt. And I needed to have a break. I didn't know how to do anything. I couldn't write an email. So I knew what I wanted to write, but I had to get Kate to come in and write emails for me. I knew what I had to do, but it's like my body and my head had just, what's the word? Disconnected. So that was, yeah, that was pretty scary in that. And I, you know, I knew I'd been over to Bali earlier that year with the NTCA, and I knew that if I went into the Indonesia airport, that I didn't have to go through all the people like that, you know, that want, you know, taxi and all that noise. And I knew that I could go off to the side and go to the hotel and stay there. And I knew that if I got picked up, I wouldn't have to do anything, because I mean, for me to go somewhere in Australia, like I think I got one quote and they're like, you're going to have to be in here for 6 weeks and this is going to be 150,000. Like, and I was like, wow, I didn't even, you know that that's, you know, what help costs. So with my budget, it was, I think I just need time out. I can go to Bali and I can do a retreat there for 7 days and stay a couple extra days and come home. And I did, and it helped, but my mentality was, you're right, now get back into work. So even though it took a bit for me to drive, like I made Kate drive a fair bit because I didn't trust myself, but yeah, straight back into work. So this was in January. Cameron left to go overseas for 6 weeks in March, and I had 60 people rock up at the station that we did the training with. So for me, my easiest thing is to revert back into work.
I was going to say, good on you for going and doing that at a time, you know, like when you've got a new staff member rocking up and, you know, saying, I need you to look after the kid. And because I know how hard that would have been, when it would have been so much easier, not easier, but more comfortable to go, well, no, I'm going to be the tough, you know, whatever, and just whatever, we'll just wait. It's not the right time, right? So you put your health first, which is really important. But then I was like, oh, that's really good. But then, yeah, you've been like, and then I went to Bali for a week and came back and just fell right back into my old patterns, which you all do.
Because it's nearly embarrassing. You know, there was a big stigma around it. So I think I had that stigma too. Plus, if I didn't do what I loved doing, which was helping people in the role that I was in, what was I going to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely owe that year to Kate. It makes me a bit emotional, but she was always there just to help me be organized. And like, I remember I used to go and I'd travel, and next thing she's got my bloody watch and my, you know, everything's lined up. So she was just amazing that year just to help me still move forward in where I needed to go and what I wanted to do. But yeah, definitely probably shouldn't have buried myself back into work.
I think it's such a common thing though. It's like, I know if you get heat stroke, you're dehydrated. All right, just go rest up for a few hours, put a cold compress on your head, have some electrolytes, and then the next day you're right to go again. Yeah. But when it comes to mental health, like you can't do that. It's something that takes a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's coming. I think the biggest thing for me is I didn't want to accept it, right? So we can keep pushing things under the carpet, but it's not until we accept something and go, okay, well, what is it that I can do now to help fix it? Like I was told by, you know, a few mentors that come through that, hey, it's time for you to leave. It's time for you to move on and re-energize, work out what's going on. I'm like, no. Like if I left, like what does that make me look like? You know, so, you know, I thank them for that advice, but it's not, you can't go until you're ready. And after that, you know, husband went away, there was still, we still went through a lot of issues. Like I think we've been pushed to the brim in what we've gone through as a couple, but we've come out the other side, which is fantastic. And it's been a long journey. I think I went through life, and I think that's because I went through life as a tick box. Like, you know, like you leave school, get engaged, we had kids and then got engaged or whatever it was, whatever way it was just like, okay, I'm ticking boxes. Yeah. So I think I went through life. I wasn't present. Now doing what I do, I'm learning to be present, and yeah, I definitely wasn't present. Like I love, like don't get me wrong, like this story sort of gone into my mental health and my, you know, what happened to me, but I absolutely love the lifestyle. Like I love the lifestyle. I love the adventure and everything else. It was just what was compounding to me.
where did you go from there when you got back, and how did you get to where you are today?
It was a bloody long road.
Yeah.
It was a long 3 years. So I got back and, you know, obviously put myself back into work and, you know, we were probably in rock bottom in our relationship. So that was trying to put on the mask, like you're in the house, things aren't probably working out. You step outside, everything's okay. So you're putting on these masks constantly, you know, in front of the kids, trying to work it out in front of the kids as well, but not knowing where to go or what to do. But from that, I kept doing my job and digging myself into that job. And he went for his 6 weeks and then he had to come back and he went, you know, he wasn't in the best state either. So when he come back and then the year after he had to go do another 6 weeks somewhere over in America and we were getting better by then, like things had started picking up. But I said, you know what, I'm going to apply for an Nuffield scholarship. Because he said to me, you could do it. And I thought, when I told him to do it, because I thought I couldn't do it because I was the female, because I seen it and I wanted to do it. I love to travel. I went over to America and lived there But what I realized is that actually I am going to apply. And my subject was staff retention, Northern Beef. And that's where I went in. And stepping into that interview, like writing application letter was in on the last second, I reckon, because I was like, do I, don't I? I felt sick applying because I've got 3 kids. So who are you as a mum to up and leave and travel for 16 weeks overseas? This is the stigma and judgment that I was thinking that whether people were putting it on me or not, this is what I was going through. And then I put it in on the last second and I made the interviews for Northern Territory, and stepping into that interview, I think was the next major change in my life, because I was so scared. I wore high heels, God knows why I wore high heels, but I went in there and, you know, they all just made it normal. I remember sitting at the head of the table. There was 8 other people high up in the industry. Me thinking that I wasn't allowed, you know, if I'd seen them in the street, I'd be too scared to talk to them because there's that hierarchy. Like that was my take on it, not theirs, mine. And yeah, so, you know, we got through that interview and waited and waited to hear if I'd made the next one. And I did, and I made myself sick. I think I cried for a day because I didn't know what was next. Yeah, so I think from that decision of going for a Nuffield scholarship, I think I was still trying to prove to everyone else and not me, but it was the best decision of my life. The people that I have met, and I still haven't finished it because of COVID, but the people that I have met in that journey have been huge mentors and great friends. I was able to travel last year. I did a global focus program and we went to Zimbabwe, UK, Spain, Italy, and then I did a week over in Switzerland. So it was the life. It was my changing, like the life changing point or whatever you want to call it. And I remember I was going away for 9 weeks. I was packed to go away for 9 weeks in 2020. By the time we got to Darwin, it was down to 4 weeks because the borders had started closing everywhere. And got to Queensland and were there for 4 days. But in that 4 days, the guy that was facilitating, he was from, I think, Scotland or UK, and he was a coach. And I'd never heard what a coach was before. And I cried when I had to come home because I was like, oh my God, I just met all these people from overseas and now I have to go home. Like, what does that mean for me? What's that mean for my journey now? I felt bad because I was, you know, going home to my kids and family, but I was upset that I was, you know, going home. So I had all these different emotions going on. But as soon as I got home, I Googled what a coach was, went, oh, wow, I can do that with my skills now. I love training people. I love helping people with a bit more education behind me. I can do this as a consulting or my own business. So that's what I started looking into. And at the same time, Manblu had sold and we were able to take the opportunity to start our own thing. So it's like it all aligned. And yeah, it's been the best thing for our family and my husband's relationship. You know, we've got, we surround ourselves by really cool people. We're able to sort of reflect on what we would have done different and step away and breathe. So I remember the first time of just having no pool or not going anywhere was the day that we actually finished up at Mambaloo. I went to the Pop Rocket Cafe and I just sat there and said, I've got nowhere to be. And it was amazing.
It's also really brave because you said, you know, the station sold and you took the opportunity. Really, like, you had a choice. You guys could very easily have stepped into another manager's job anywhere else, like, yeah, very easily. But you made a really bold choice to go out on your own and do something for you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a huge gamble and stepping out of your comfort zone. And
yeah. And it had, like, it's been 3.5 years now. So it is. And, you know, there's been, it's so easy to step back on station. And, you know, it's not that we wouldn't, you know, the reason for moving is because I think we both knew that we needed to, that we wanted something different. We wanted something for ourselves, but business is hard as well, but it's our choices now that we're getting to do. And, you know, we get to choose what we want.
Tell me about what you're doing now with the new business that you've started.
Yeah. So I was, you know, as I said, it all sort of started falling into place. And Trudy Oxley, you know, when she found out that I was leaving and said, well, will you come and, you know, design some sort of leadership course for PGS systems in profitable grazing systems for Meat Livestock Australia. And I was like, yeah. So I went through some conversations with them, and this is, you know, the workshop Lead with Certainty come around. And my business now is all about coaching, mentoring and delivering workshops on leadership. I've got three pillars that I use in leadership, and it's leading you, leading others and leading teams. And there's a fair bit of emphasis on leading you, because through my journey and seeing other people's, if we don't have a good self-awareness of us and where we are, how can we efficiently lead others? So now I get to work with so many amazing people and helping them through that journey of having that self-awareness around themselves and others to be able to know quicker what's going on so they don't go through the same journey that I did.
It's so cool to see, like, it's full circle for you. And I just wonder, like, what would have the story have been if you'd had all this knowledge at the start?
I look back and say, I could have done so many things better. And if I knew what I knew now, things would be different. But then on the other hand, if I knew what I knew now, I probably wouldn't be here. Yeah. And my journey has led me here for a reason.
Yeah.
And it gives me goosebumps because I absolutely love where I am and what I get to do and the impact I get to have on others. And that's through that journey. So I think that everything I've been through has happened for me, not to me, which enables me to be able to go, okay, and just give people self-awareness. You learn through, like, the biggest way we learn is through mistakes. So the biggest thing that I want to get across to people is that they can lead. They don't have to be that dominant leader. They can lead by being who they are, as long as they've got standards and accountability in place. They've got self-awareness around themselves and others. And they know where they want to go. And it's the same as an industry-wide thing. The staff, you know, I want people to stay in the industry. It's a great industry. But with the wrong leaders, people are leaving. So if we can make more of a ripple effect and help the leaders that are in there, because, like, let's be honest, everyone's getting put into leadership roles earlier. They may know, have a slight grasp on the skills that they need to do, but then they've got, you know, maybe 30,000 head of cattle that they need to look after. They've got 8 to 10 staff, or don't like that word, but they've got 8 to 10 team members within their team with all different personalities that they're trying to work out. And they might be 21. So they don't even know how to lead themselves or what's going on. So normally they'll do it, but they like their title and they may like the salary and they like the thrill of being in this position, but they may only stay for 3 years and then, like, oh, I'm burnt, you know, without maybe recognizing they're burnt. They're like, I've had enough.
Yeah.
But it's through burnout of not being able to be equipped with the tools to be able to, you know, do the job that they need to do efficiently. So, you know, I've got the 2-day workshop, but I've also got a 12-month program that I've got that they can hop on weekly. And we've got a community of leaders and people in there that normalize the fact that everyone's sort of going through the same thing.
Yeah. And that you're not supposed to know it all, especially at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, you do schools on everything else. It's very normal to do like a horse school, like horse training school, horse shooting school, livestock school, and a chemical course, whatever. But when do you do the people side of things? And at the end of the day, like working with people is very different than working with horses and cattle. Mm. For the most part, you, any set of yards you walk into at any point in the year, you should be able to position yourself the same and expect a standard response from the cattle.
Yeah.
You can't do that with people.
Yeah.
Like you can have four people in front of you and you need to ask them to do something. You might have to tell them all slightly different or, you know, it's very, I'm thinking back to what I said a moment ago about, you know, imagine if you'd had all this knowledge and insight at the start of your career. But I think, like you said, it's all worked out for the best because you've learned things the hard way.
Yeah.
And you've lived it and it's been a lot of blood, sweat and tears to get to where you are. So who better to be able to teach that? Like you said, you've done some formal training to, you know, kind of polish it up and bring it all together. But, you know, and you've got that life experience. I mean, I'm sure you can go to uni and probably come out straight out with something and start teaching these things, but you can't match what you've gone through. And the stories you've shared today and the whole roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
And it just, I guess, looking back on it now, it all kind of makes sense how it was leading to you. Yeah. But there's no way you could have known that at the time.
Yeah, no way. So if we go right back to the beginning when I said I wanted to be a nurse, I realized quickly I didn't want to be a nurse, but I think it was I wanted to help people. And, you know, through high school I was helping people and now I'm living my best life because I get to help people. I have a better understanding of who I am. I can work out when I need to be present and I'm actually more present nearly all the time now. So, and yeah, just to help make an impact.
So it has been one heck of a roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
Looking back on your story so far and this period of your life, what would you say is the major takeaway lesson for you?
Oh, this might make me teary, but it's believe in yourself. I think it's don't try and prove yourself to anyone. I spent a lot of my life trying to prove myself to lots of different people, but in the end I worked out that I needed to prove myself to myself. And then I realized I didn't, which leads into that you're enough. I don't have a uni degree. I've been through a fair bit, but I am where I am now and I've been through the journey. You know, I am enough. So it feels a bit wanky if you want to say, like, to a lot of people saying that, but you have to believe in yourself and you have to back yourself into where you want to go. And you don't have to do it alone.
If you'd like to learn more about what Tammy does now and get more information on her workshops and coaching programs, check out our show notes for the links, or you can search Tammy Krakow Coaching online.